So a bit tonight about practicing in ordinary life, which I'm going to call everything except for formal meditation, which is not unordinary. So I'm not even sure what ordinary, I'm never quite sure what to call. Whenever we say practicing in ordinary life, daily life, everyday life, we kind of use that term. I think most often it's used by retreat teachers who want to say, retreat is really dramatic, and it's really dramatically different from everything else that we do. So how do you practice during the everything else time? But I kind of like the Tibetan, the sort of casual Tibetan term that you'll hear. They just say non-meditation. And don't get all non-dual on me and be like, everything is meditation. It is, or it can be, but then the word is meaningless. So I'll say non-meditation, meaning essentially activity. If meditation in a certain way is defined by stillness, and again, we'll set aside movement meditations like Qigong and yoga for the moment, but meditation, as we often talk about it here, especially orienting toward deep internal inquiry of vipassana, or the deep absorption of jhana or samadhi, those are all essentially wakeful stillness. This is the term I was using in the meditation tonight. And so the rest of our day, other than the part when we're asleep, is filled with wakeful activity, you know, non-stillness. So non-meditation or non-stillness. So how should we practice during the non-stillness parts of our day? Generally, we will talk about activity being supported by practice where the quality of mindfulness is central. And you've all heard these teachings lots of times, to be mindful while you do whatever, right? Often when we say to be mindful during activity, we mean a combination of a couple of things. So I want to unpack that a little bit. Very often when I say I'm being mindful at all, it includes both trying to be non-distracted, so trying to not let the mind wander unintentionally towards something that is not what I'm actually doing. Mostly, distraction means not intentional thinking, right? I could be intentionally trying to reflect on something, to think about a conversation I'm going to have, or to write something, or to do a task that requires thinking. And those tasks could involve coming up with words in my mind, but I wouldn't say I'm distracted, right? I'm actually doing a thing with my mind. And so when we say distraction, mostly I think what we mean is that the discursive mind, usually the words making mind, but distraction can be in images as well. So the word or image mind is engaged in a process that I didn't intend, right? So distraction is unintentional. If that's what distraction is, then mindfulness in a certain way is, could be said, use your mind intentionally. If I'm using my mind intentionally, it means whatever I'm doing, I mean to be doing it. And because there's a moment, there's a totally appropriate moment for, you know, planning, let's say, the future. I'm about to go on a trip with my family. I'm about to go and do retreat. All of these require some amount of planning. When it's the right time for me to do that planning, you know, like I say to myself, let's plan the retreat, or let's plan the trip, and I get out a piece of paper, I'm going to make a list, whatever it is, it's not distraction. I'm doing it on purpose. But if I'm sitting in meditation, or I'm, you know, trying to, you know, talk to somebody at work or something, and my mind goes by itself to the planning, I might call it worry or anxiety or just planning mind. But if I'm not intending it, then it's a distraction, right? So here I am in the non-meditation part of my day. What's healthy, or what's a useful for practice way to train myself for these non-meditation or non-stillness parts of the day? So one of these is trying not to be not distracted. And so that's an attention task. I'm trying to keep my attention stuck to what I'm actually intending to do. So whatever it is, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, whether it's creative or dull or logistical or, you know, whatever, and whether it's intellectual or manual, you know, whether I'm out like tearing up crabgrass, which I did for a bit today, or I'm, you know, fixing budget numbers on a spreadsheet for work, which I also did a bit of today. In both of those, my aim is for my discursive mind to be present only with what's happening. In a certain way, it's easier when the thing that's happening is not discursive itself. So there's something wonderful about, you know, pulling up the crabgrass, where I can do the activities of, you know, digging and forking and shaking off dirt and ripping things up, and I can actually let my mind space be a bit quiet because I'm focused on the sensory activity. Different from, you know, I'm staring at the budget numbers. So for some folks, that's true. The manual activity, washing the dishes, pulling the weeds, whatever you're doing that doesn't involve necessary discursive thought, you can practice quieting the mind in that situation. For some folks, it's the reverse, right? Like doing the numbers on the spreadsheet or doing the discursive intellectual task, it gives your mind something to do. You have to think through it so you're not distracted while you do it. But then as soon as I'm not actually having to do that and I'm doing some manual thing, I'm walking somewhere, pulling the weeds, then my mind goes to where the story is. So you might feel into which of those is easier, which of those is more difficult for you to be undistracted in. So being undistracted, there's one element that's restraint, like not letting the mind go to words or images, stories mostly, that aren't about what's happening right now or where I'm not intending to go. That's the samatha or serenity or concentration side of mindfulness. When we say mindfulness, we're talking about really two things. One of them is traditionally called samatha. It translates as serenity. This is really the stilling or steadying of the mind aspect. And the other one is vipassana, which tonight I'm going to translate as clarity. It's clear seeing. You could also translate it sometimes as inquiry or understanding. This is the investigative and exploratory aspect of being present. Samatha practice is about steadiness. It's about really learning to be undistracted in a sustained way without the mind flickering away. And in a sense, samatha practice is about bringing the mind under control. And I'll put that in scare quotes so that you don't get scared away by thinking that I'm trying to make you control your mind somehow. I am, but a lot of us don't like that kind of language, right? It sounds like I'm trying to clamp down on something, which doesn't work. So don't, you know, it's control in the way that that you train a Labrador to be a seeing eye dog. You do it gently and persistently, but the result is a very useful animal, and in many cases, a very happy animal. But it's a different animal than a free puppy chasing squirrels, right? This is a dog who has learned not to chase squirrels because they're in an intimate relationship with the human that they're serving, and that they're friends with, and they're guiding, and they're doing work in the world. They're alert, but their impulses are under control. And so there is an aspect of control in mindfulness. And particularly what we're controlling is we're controlling attention from following the impulse toward distraction. That's the control that we're talking about. And as we talk about a lot here, the pathways to that are gentle and not forceful, because force doesn't work so much. Same with training the dog. Mostly force doesn't work. But constancy and persistence in the discipline works. And so we have to figure out what the right balance in that training is for ourselves. But samatha really is the restraint practice. We learn how to not follow impulse. In a certain way, samatha is like the adult version of the thing that we have to teach toddlers, which is impulse control. You know, when you get mad and you want to hit somebody, you know, you don't hit them. When you get mad and you want to yell at somebody, you don't yell at them. You move the energy some other way. And as adults, maybe you have been well trained enough that you don't very often hit people and yell at them anymore, right? Blessings to your discipline, your inner discipline, because sometimes they sure deserve it. You know, maybe, I don't know, you might say that. But you know, you're a mature adult and you don't do that. So, you know, samatha is just taking that further. You know, an impulse arises to worry about something. I notice the impulse and I don't follow it. And I have to do a few things in order to be able to not follow it. One is that I have to know that I'm going to make, or I have already made, intentional space to think about whatever it is. So if I'm worried about the planning that I have to do for the retreat next week, I need to make intentional space to do that planning so that when the impulse to worry about it comes up, I either know that I've already done the planning and I can dismiss that impulse, or I know that I'm going to, so I don't have to worry about it now. In all of those cases, I'm working with this impulse arising to do something that's not what I'm planning to do right now. And I restrain that. And so the samatha side is the restraint side. So we practice that. And throughout the day, there's all of these moments where we can practice that. And I think that often we get the side of mindfulness that encourages us toward presence. Presence being a kind of non-distracted, you know, being with what is. I'm essentially saying yes to that, but I want to point out that if we don't intentionally take up the discipline of quieting the discursive mind as we are present, very often we can slip into a kind of weak presence. Like I'm generally present, but the mind still kind of just wanders. And in some insight teachers and some Zen teachers as well will give this kind of instruction that the wandering mind isn't a problem as long as you're mindful of it, right? So you can observe the mind wandering. Often the background for an instruction like this is that the thinking mind is considered in the Dharma to be a sense organ, like the ear or the eyes. So in the same way that right now I can hear the frogs singing, and I don't have to stop them singing in order to feel at peace, I could notice a distracting thought, and I don't have to stop it in order to be at peace. And that's true. That's a vipassana instruction. Because vipassana is the side of practice that doesn't need us to quiet the mind. What it needs is for us to understand everything that's arising as it arises. So I can notice the frog singing, I can notice that I like it, and I can notice even that I'm a little attached to it. Like a couple of years ago we were in a drought and it was this time of year and they weren't singing so much because it was too dry and they weren't around. They were still in their mud holes. And I missed them. And I wanted them. And I didn't like that we were in a drought. And or I might hear them and really be like thrilled that it's springtime. And not look forward to what we now call fire season, August, September, October. So, that's mild grasping. It's not terribly I'm not suffering terribly, but I can notice that I have a preference, right? It's the practice of vipassana to know that. And so vipassana is the part of practice where in any given moment I tune into what's prominent in my field, in the experiential system, and I'm aware of what's in the foreground, right? So right now there's a few things that are foreground. There's, of course, the stream of my speaking to you and your presence on the screen. There's the frogs singing. Those two things are most foreground in my attention right now. I can turn my attention to other things. During the meditation, I was a little sleepy. That came to the foreground a little bit. So I'm aware of what's in the foreground. And then vipassana goes further. It doesn't try to just quiet my mind and be fully with what's there. That's the samatha side. If I want to strengthen non-distracted presence, particularly if I'm trying to quiet the energetic system a bit, I'm going to lean in the direction of samatha. And that means I hear the frogs and I'm going to settle my attention. Let the sound of the frogs come up. And I'm not going to worry too much about, like, oh, there's a little grasping or here's my relationship to it or whatever. I'm just going to quiet the mind. Get really quiet. Be present with the sensory field. And let the pleasure of silence and presence grow stronger. That's the samatha side. So any time in my day, I can do that. You can do it while you're doing a cognitive task, while you're doing a manual task. Often I'll do samatha in between things. So when I get up from a task at the computer and I'm walking downstairs to make tea, I will, on purpose, as soon as I get up, I'll quiet the thinking mind. So I try not to take my task with me. It doesn't always work, but I try. And then I see if during the walk from my office out the door, down the stairs to the kitchen, turn the kettle on, go outside and stand in the sun while I'm waiting for the water to boil. I try to just turn off the words, be with the moving body, the sounds around, really be with physicality in a silent way. So that's samatha. Vipassana is the investigative side. I hear the frogs. I get that I really like it. I have a preference there. And vipassana goes, vipassana takes the noticing to the point of understanding suffering. That's the whole purpose. So the sequence in vipassana might be something like, I hear the frogs, that's hearing, first foundation of mindfulness. I notice that I like it, that's vedana, it's pleasant, second foundation of mindfulness. I notice that I prefer when they're there versus when they're not. That's grasping, second noble truth. And then I notice I notice any contraction or suffering created by that preference, right? So you don't just notice the preference and the wanting. You don't stop there, because There's all sorts of things that you want. Some of them are lovely, some of them are not lovely. The place that vipassana goes is you take it all the way to the first noble truth. That's where we're going with this. So sensory contact, vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, preference, second noble truth, and then the ouch, or the dissatisfaction, first noble truth. And it's the practice of vipassana to get really smooth in that sequence. You start with whatever's happening. You see how you're reacting to it, essentially. And then you see the result of that reaction in your inner sense of freedom. And being mindful of the Four Noble Truths is the last exercise in the fourth foundation of mindfulness. It's where the whole mindfulness system leads. And the noble truths are really to be seen moment to moment. So, I'm I'm nearing the end of my workday, someone pings me with a request for something, it's kind of difficult, or it's easy but unpleasant, or for whatever reason, I'm, you know, minorly annoyed that I have to do this thing. It's the nature of work, it's no problem. But if I'm doing Vipassana in that moment, what I'll do is I'll just pause, right? I read the email, that's, you know, sensory contact. I notice that it's unpleasant, that's Vedana. It takes a microsecond to notice Vedana. It's, you already know it. All mindfulness does is it says, I see you, you know? I see you, ping of unpleasantness, you know? Mind moment of unpleasantness. You just notice that. And then, you know, and then I notice the wishing things were otherwise, right? That's the second noble truth, craving. It's like, oh, you know, that tiny little urge that's like, I wish I didn't have to do this. And then the last step, and really I want to emphasize that the last step is actually the one that's important. All of that other stuff, that's getting there. You're being mindful. You're learning about your reactivities. You're learning your nervous system. But the thing that really makes it Vipassana is that you feel, and I think it's really a somatic sensing, you feel the dissatisfaction, the suffering, the dukkha. So dukkha, suffering, dissatisfaction, unsatisfactoriness. And it's particularly great to do this, I think, not just with the big, enormous, unpleasant or pleasant things. So there's some big stuff happening in some social circles near me. I can tune into those things. You know, I lost a dear friend and sometime teacher and community member a couple weeks ago in a sudden heart failure at an early age. You can notice the unsatisfactoriness of big losses easily. And that's good. It's good to notice that and to process it, to notice that there's wanting, that there's suffering. But in terms of the flow of everyday life, I think Vipassana really starts to get some momentum when you're awake to changing sensory experience. That's like basic presence. You're awake to the fluctuations of Vedana, the fluctuations of I like it, I don't like it, I like it, or pleasant, it's really pleasant, unpleasant, kind of neutral, pleasant, neutral, unpleasant, neutral, 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 bored, unpleasant, 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 unpleasant. You know, like you watch the waves of Vedana go on, and then you watch your preferences, and just, you know, and you can have a kind of, like, don't even be too attached to what you see, you know, like, oh my God, I have so many preferences. Of course you do. You know, of course you're into, sometimes I think the structure of our personalities is entirely composed of preferences. Like that's what a personality is a big set of preferences. So it's all second noble truth. You know, that beautiful poem from the third Zen patriarch, Tsang-tsan, that begins, the great way is not difficult for one who has no preferences. As soon as liking and disliking are set up against each other, heaven and earth are far apart. So notice the preference engine inside your being. And then notice the first noble truth as it arises. So that subtle wishing it were different, right? I wish this thing that feels good would go on longer. I wish this thing I didn't like wouldn't happen or would stop sooner. And in a moment-to-moment way through the day, this is always happening. And, you know, if you're having a relatively good day, it's just that just means it's happening quieter. And so when we put these two modes together, the samatha mode of quieting distraction, really steadying the attention, and we put the vipassana mode of investigating together, there can be the sense that in any given moment, you can choose either one of those to emphasize. I think a good mix for mindfulness generally is a blend of the two. And for different folks, you'll find a different blend. Some, you might have a more like inquiry oriented or investigative kind of personality, and you like hanging out in Vipassana. It's just interesting to move through your day. Often I'll do this in phases. I'll have some phase where I just want to see all the preferences. And I'll move through my day just noticing all the little flickers of I want it, I don't want it, I want it, I don't want it. So I'm emphasizing the Vipassana side. Other times, I don't really care about that. I'm like, I know my preferences. It's so repetitive. And what I really want to do is I want a few moments peace, thank you very much. And then I really turn toward the Samatha side. And those of you who've been hanging out with me for many years, maybe you've noticed, but I've noticed that I think I'm tilting at this moment in my life, and maybe it's because I have an 8-year-old and a full-time job, and things are just really a bit loud and busy much of the time. I'm finding myself really favoring the Samatha side more and more. And I think for a lot of us in very busy kinds of lives, in the complexity of our culture right now, don't undervalue the Samatha side. And if anything, if that's the more unusual side, and particularly if that feels like the more difficult side, you're like, oh yeah, I can investigate my preferences all day long, but really stop the thinking mind and rest in silence, that's hard. If that's you, give it some attention, is my gentle encouragement. And I think this is also a fun way to practice, because sometimes I think we think of meditative silence as primarily associated with the cushion, often. Like I can really quiet my mind when I sit down for meditation, but once I get up and I'm moving around and I'm doing a lot of things, all bets are off. My mind is just not so much on a short leash anymore. And so I want to encourage, find the blend of Samatha and Vipassana throughout the changing activities of your day that feels like it works well for you. And of course, it could be different every day. It changes all the time, depending on your energy. But don't neglect the Samatha side and really give some attention to like, okay, what would it be like actually to practice being undistracted? Not just in meditation, but as I go to the grocery store, at some point, go to the store and see if you can, go from your house to the car, to the store, to the checkout, to the car, and back to the house, without your mind going on a long journey into planning or worry or anxiety. But just stay completely with the thing. Just drive the car. And that's a classic meditation instruction, just wash the dishes, just drive the car. But don't focus just on the activity. It's not a strong enough anchor for the mind. Trying to just drive, really focusing on the driving, for a lot of folks, that's not enough. The mind will still wander away because you're really good at driving and thinking, and being distracted. So quiet the mind intentionally every, few breaths or so, right? And for most of us, we have to do this in a pretty consistent way. Again, the classic analogy is that you're training a puppy. And you keep your hand about 6 inches up on the leash, like really close. The puppy bolts, you give just a little, heel. And you do that every breath or two for a little while until it's pretty quiet. And then see if you can just glide through the aisles of, whatever your grocery is, the community grocery, Berkeley Bowl, whatever, wherever you are, all of the hell realms. Don't let your mind go. Right, keep it close. If tension starts to build up, calm it down, right? Really settle, really relax. And so that's a different emphasis for mindfulness practice than we sometimes get in mindfulness instructions that just emphasize a kind of open sensory presence. Open sensory presence, but add the Samatha training of really quieting the mind. And yes, as Kimberly is mentioning in chat, this is really a way to talk about monotasking versus multitasking. Monotasking, but again, still including the intentional quieting of the discursive mind. When you don't have to be thinking about something, don't think about something. And it's really easy to say that in a kind of cheeky way, and I know how tremendously difficult it is. So this is really a discipline to take on. And as you do it, you'll start to notice it's uncanny, the pleasure of moving through the city. If you live in a city, the uncanniness of moving through the city with a quiet mind, it can be very oddly exhilarating and strange. Everybody's thinking, and you can feel it. You can feel the thought energy just radiating out of people. And you just move through that, and you have nothing to say to yourself inside. So there's an encouragement for the non-meditation side of practice. Thanks for listening with such quiet and lovely attention.